The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter, as well as the Harvard Heart Letter. And in fact, the first article is from the Harvard Health Letter and is entitled, Five Important Blood Tests Beyond the Basics. They suggest bringing this article to your next doctor appointment to ask if these tests are right for you. This article, by the way, comes from the July 2021 issue. Your next general checkup will probably include basic blood tests for levels of red blood cells, various types of white blood cells, fats like cholesterol, and chemicals that indicate how your liver and kidneys are functioning. Some tests beyond the basics can also reveal important aspects of health, but your doctor might not offer them routinely. The following five tests may be worth pursuing in certain situations. The first is vitamin B12. B12, or cobalamin, is an essential vitamin we need for keeping our brain and nerves healthy, for producing DNA and red blood cells, and for lowering levels of homocysteine, an amino acid linked to chronic diseases, like dementia and heart disease. Our B12 comes from food, including beef, eggs, poultry, and dairy foods. To absorb the vitamin, we need stomach acid. Then a protein called intrinsic factor made in the stomach binds to B12 so it can be absorbed by the small intestine and passed into the blood. Some people have low B12 levels. There are several common reasons for this. Perhaps they are vegetarians and don't eat B12-rich foods. They may produce less stomach acid than they used to. They use medications that reduce stomach acid, like antacids for heartburn. Or possibly they have a rare autoimmune disease called pernicious anemia that leads to severe B12 deficiency. Should you get the test? I think everybody should get at least one B12 test after age 65 and then get tested every few years. Low B12 levels can lead to anemia, memory problems, and walking difficulty, says Dr. Suzanne Salomon, Associate Chief of Gerontology at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Normal B12 levels range from 160 to 950. A low normal test in the range of 200 to 300 may warrant a vitamin B12 supplement. Vitamin D. We get a little vitamin D in our diet from foods like fish, fortified milk, or yogurt. But most of it is manufactured by our bodies when the sun's ultraviolet light, B rays, shine on our skin. That's why D is known as the sunshine vitamin. Many older adults are deficient in vitamin D no matter how sunny their environment. It doesn't matter if you live in Florida or California because as you get older, your skin doesn't absorb sunlight as well, Dr. Salomon says. You don't want to let vitamin D levels drop. Vitamin D is important for healthy bones, calcium absorption, inflammation reduction, immune function, and other body processes, and it may play a role in keeping cancer in check. As we reported in June 2021, recent Harvard evidence suggests that taking a daily vitamin D supplement is associated with a reduced risk for advanced cancer in healthy weight, middle, or older age people. Should you get the test? Dr. Salomon recommends a baseline test at least once in your life, especially if you have brittle bones or a stomach condition that affects your ability to absorb vitamin D. But she points out that screening is hotly debated. What if you have a high risk for cancer? While you may feel better knowing what your vitamin D levels are, an alternative is to skip the test and just take a supplement of 1,000 to 2,000 international units per day. If adding another pill to your regimen would overwhelm you, talk to your doctor about it first, says Dr. Joanne Manson, Harvard's leading vitamin D researcher and chief of the Division of Preventive Medicine at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. A normal result for a vitamin D test measuring a form of the vitamin is debated, but should be at least 20 nanograms per milliliter. Hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a viral infection that can lead to cirrhosis, liver damage, liver cancer, or liver failure. It's spread when a person comes in contact with the blood of an infected person, which can happen with intravenous drug use, having sex with an infected partner, getting a tattoo or body piercing with unsterile equipment, sharing razors, nail clippers, or toothbrushes, or having had a blood transfusion before 1992. That was when the blood test for hepatitis C first became available. Baby boomers, those born between 1945 and 1964, who are five times more likely to have the virus than other adults, may have become infected in the 1960s through the 1980s. Yet only about 13% of baby boomers have been tested by 2015. It could be due to the stigma, but I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of doctors don't offer the test. They may think their patients aren't at risk for hepatitis C, Dr. Salomon says. All U.S. adults should be tested at least once, and more often if they take part in risky behavior. The good news, there is a cure for hepatitis C if you catch the infection early, Dr. Salomon says. HIV. Since HIV and AIDS, the late-stage phase of HIV infection, first appeared decades ago, we've developed powerful antiviral medications to keep the infection from progressing. But like hepatitis C testing, HIV testing has a stigma. HIV is transmitted when someone is exposed to certain body fluids of an infected person. That can happen during vaginal or anal sex or the sharing of drug equipment such as needles. The CDC advises everyone aged 13 to 64 to get tested at least once and warns that older adults are less likely to be screened because they or their doctors don't think they're at risk for HIV. Yet 1 in 6 people diagnosed with HIV in 2018 was 50 or older. Get this test if you've never had it before or if you're sexually active, Dr. Salomon advises. Next is blood sugar. People with diabetes or prediabetes have elevated levels of glucose in the blood. A blood sugar measurement taken after fasting may be ordered during a checkup and is covered by Medicare. But Dr. Salomon says primary care physicians don't always check your levels every year. Should you get the test? If your blood sugar is normal, a test every few years is fine, but it still might be a good idea to get annual testing. Some people are silent diabetics who don't have symptoms, and you wouldn't pick this up unless you ordered the test, Dr. Salomon says. People at high risk for diabetes, like those who are overweight or have diabetes in their family, may need more frequent tests. A normal fasting blood sugar measurement is less than 100 milligrams per deciliter of blood. 126 or more can indicate diabetes. But normal levels change with age and can be slightly higher. Your doctor needs to interpret the results, Dr. Salomon says. Now we're going to go to another article in the Harvard Health Letter. This is called Ask the Doctor by Dr. Anthony L. Komaroff, who is the editor-in-chief. The first question, In the April 2021 issue, you said that atherosclerosis, obesity, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes are all related and affect each other. Which of them starts first? It's true these conditions often occur together. Not only that, but having some of them can increase the risk of getting the others. For example, being obese increases your risk of developing type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure. And having either of these conditions or high blood levels of cholesterol increase your risk of heart disease and stroke caused by atherosclerosis, in which cholesterol deposits form in the walls of the arteries. How does one condition affect another? As one example, blood banging at high pressure against the walls of arteries injures them, making them more likely to develop cholesterol deposits and to increase the size of any deposits that already are present. And as you'd expect, high levels of blood cholesterol also increase the risk for and size of cholesterol deposits. Which comes first? Cholesterol starts building up in artery walls in childhood. Although it usually takes decades for the atherosclerosis to become significant enough to cause heart attacks and stroke, the disease starts early. That's why increasingly cholesterol and blood pressure, long thought of as adult health problems, also are measured and treated in children, not just in adults. The next question. I've heard that toxins are flushed out of the brain during sleep. Is that true? One of the most interesting discoveries in the past decade is that the brain has a waste management system. Like people, in order to have the energy to do their work, brain cells need to eat to absorb primarily sugar and oxygen. And as in people, meals lead to wastes that need to be disposed of. The waste management system, called the glymphatic system, is a series of tubes that carry fresh fluid into the brain, mix the fresh fluid with the waste-filled fluid that surrounds the brain cells, and then flush the mix out of the brain and into the blood. This occurs primarily during deep sleep. There's some evidence that under-functioning waste management system may play a role in neurodegeneration that follows traumatic brain injury, as experienced by some football players, for example. It may even play a role in other brain disorders, like Alzheimer's disease. Since chronic sleep deprivation increases the risk for various brain disease, it's plausible that it does so by reducing the function of the waste management system. Why do we sleep? We know it helps to rest the body and to consolidate memories and learning. Perhaps we also need to sleep to flush wastes from our brain. The next article from the Harvard Health Letter of July 2021 is entitled, Man's Best Friend and Medicines Too? Dogs may one day help identify certain health conditions early. For as long as dogs have been domesticated, humans have relied on them for companionship and their remarkable sense of smell. Dogs and their super sniffers help humans hunt, track criminals, and detect guns, drugs, or explosives in airports. Now, scientists are investigating whether dogs can also help sniff out disease before humans know they have them. A dog's keen sense of smell outranks ours many times over. For example, dogs' brains devote more real estate to analyzing scent than ours. Their noses have 60 times the number of scent receptors as ours, about 300 million versus our 5 million, and their smell accuracy is far more precise than ours. Dogs have exquisitely sensitive noses and can detect molecules in the parts per trillion range. Humans, in contrast, typically detect odors in the parts per million range, says Dr. Sophia Koo, an infectious disease specialist at Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. In theory, then, dogs should be well suited to picking up odors generated by bacteria or diseased human cells. These organisms and cells produce molecules with distinct and often subtle scents that come out in our breath, body fluids, skin, or bowel movement. As the molecules evaporate in air, they become detectable. For example, we know there are molecules associated with prostate cancer that can seep into urine, and presumably they should be detectable with sensitive enough techniques, says Dr. Paul Wynn, a radiation oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. For decades now, scientists have been studying whether dogs might be able to detect many types of illnesses using their superior sense of smell. Cancer. Dogs have been studied for their ability to detect lung, skin, breast, and bladder cancer with mixed results. Scientists are now looking at whether the animals can sniff out colorectal and prostate cancer with promising results. Some of the dog studies about prostate cancer have been extremely impressive, with 90% plus accuracy, Dr. Wynn says. Infection. In small studies, dogs have had some success in identifying urinary tract infection in people of all ages and malaria in children. Dogs have correctly identified the dangerous diarrheal infection, Clostridioides difficile, in many studies. Also exciting are current efforts around the world to see if dogs can smell COVID-19 in humans. In one small randomized trial published online July 23, 2020 by BMC Infectious Disease, dogs were able to discriminate between samples from infected and uninfected people with high accuracy. The dogs identified about 83% of positive cases and 96% of negative cases. The COVID virus in the test samples was killed before the detection dogs were exposed to them. Dogs are also being studied for their potential ability to smell Parkinson's disease, as well as narcolepsy, sudden episodes of deep sleep. And pooches are already being used as service animals to alert people with diabetes to high or low blood sugar. However, using dogs for this purpose has been controversial because of an unregulated industry and claims of fraudulent dog trainers. Is it really plausible? That's PAWSSIBLE. Even though studies of medical detection dogs have been encouraging, the reality of using the animals beyond lab settings has big obstacles. One is that it's hard to get solid evidence about accuracy. Dogs have an outstanding ability to detect disease odor, but it requires intensive training of even a single dog to discriminate disease from non-disease well. Even between dogs, there's a variability in how well they can ultimately distinguish states of disease, Dr. Koo says. There are also confounders, as dogs can easily be distracted and falsely call a signal or miss a signal when distracted. Also, using medical detection dogs in the real world may be unrealistic. The concept of massive numbers of dogs professionally screening urine or other types of samples just doesn't pass the sniff test. It's impractical, and instead will need to be done with laboratory devices to make it scalable and acceptable. Accordingly, scientists, including Dr. Koo, are testing machines that may be able to detect scents. I think sophisticated scent detectors will come into use for the diagnosis of certain diseases, and that this is not just a flash in the pan, says Dr. Koo. There is a lot of potential in this area. This is why a lot of research in my own laboratory is dedicated to identifying the molecules that reveal different types of lung infections so we can build machines to detect them. And researchers know such technology has a lot to live up to. We still have a way to go, Dr. Nguyen says, before we can replicate what nature has done so elegantly with the canine sense of smell. The article goes on to point out that owning a dog has many health benefits. Studies have shown that compared with people who don't own dogs, dog owners walk more, have lower blood pressure and stress levels, eat more healthfully, and have more success losing weight, in part because of the activity necessary to walk the dog. The unconditional love and companionship dogs provide also works wonders for our emotional health, helping to stave off loneliness, which is associated with an increased risk for chronic disease and even for early death, and offer an additional sense of purpose in life to return the love your dog so freely gives you. The next article is from the Harvard Health Letter. Is entitled Chronic Inflammation and Your Joints, Why the Immune System is Sometimes the Culprit in Joint Pain. When you suffer a joint injury, maybe a banged up knee or a twisted ankle, a little inflammation is part of the healing process. Puffy, red, tender joints may indicate that your immune system is working to remove damage and promote the growth of new tissue, a healthy kind of inflammation. But sometimes the immune system launches unhealthy chronic inflammation in the joints for no apparent reason. This leads to pain, stiffness, and joint damage known as inflammatory arthritis. It's often unknown what triggers the immune system to unleash an assault on the joints, but we do know what the cells are up to once they're in action. In a common type of inflammatory arthritis like rheumatoid arthritis, a variety of immune cells can be found in the lining and the fluid of the joint. These cells attract other immune cells and together lead to thickening of the joint lining, new blood vessel formation, and ultimately joint damage, says rheumatologist Dr. Robert Schmerling, medical editor of the Harvard Special Health Report, Fighting Inflammation. Chronic inflammation in the joints can damage cartilage, bone, tendons, or ligaments, which hold joints together, irritate nerves, and produce a long list of symptoms, including pain, swelling, and stiffness. The joint damage may be progressive and irreversible. There are many types of inflammatory arthritis. Common ones include rheumatoid arthritis. Rheumatoid arthritis occurs when the immune system attacks the lining of the joints, especially in the hands, wrists, and feet. Rheumatoid arthritis may also affect the heart, lungs, and eyes. Gout. Gout is characterized by a buildup of uric acid, which can form crystals in the joints, especially in the big toe, and sometimes in the hands, wrists, or knees. The crystals activate a temporary inflammatory response that can become chronic. Calcium pyrophosphate deposition disease, which is also called pseudogout. In CPPD, calcium crystals settle in the joints, especially the knee, wrist, and shoulders, ankles, and elbows. Like the uric acid crystals in gout, the calcium crystals in CPPD prompt the body to respond with inflammation, and over time, this could become chronic. Psoriatic arthritis. About 30% of people with psoriasis develop psoriatic arthritis, which can affect the knees, ankles, wrists, or fingers. What about osteoarthritis? Osteoarthritis, a wearing away of the smooth cartilage lining joints, has long been considered a non-inflammatory form of arthritis. But we now recognize that some inflammatory cells are present in osteoarthritis, although the inflammation is much less dramatic, Dr. Schmerling says. The finding of mild chronic inflammation in osteoarthritis has been significant enough for researchers to begin investigating whether the condition can be treated with some of the same types of medications used to treat inflammatory arthritis. And what are these treatments? Well, they include non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, which reduces levels of prostaglandins, chemicals that promote inflammation, oral or injected steroids, which reduce inflammation and suppress the immune system, injections or intravenous infusions of non-biologic disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs called DMARDs, and these include medicines like methotrexate, which suppress the immune system. Injection or infusion of biologic DMARDs, antibodies like Humira, that suppress the immune system in a more targeted way than non-biologic DMARDs. Janus kinase inhibitors, such as Xeljanz, which interrupt inflammatory signals, and drugs that lower uric acid levels to treat gout. Results with drug treatment are often good. Medications to lower uric acid can essentially eliminate gout. And the development of newer drugs for rheumatoid arthritis, including biologic and Janus kinase inhibitors, make it possible for far more people than in the past to experience remission and protection from ongoing joint damage. Other ways to help reduce pain and inflammation include exercising, avoiding processed foods, reducing stress, not smoking, and getting enough sleep. Wearing a splint or brace on affected joints and seeking physical therapy may also ease your pain and keep you mobile and active. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.